What scares you, and do your fears change depending on your experiences? I'm Sonia Sly, and in part four of The Face of Fear, we look at the evolving nature of our fears. What are the modern day threats, and how do we look to control them? Well, there's no question that although we experience fear very differently as individuals, the use of fear is pervasive.
It's used by advertisers. If I don't use this deodorant, I fear that other people will think I'm stinky and won't like me. That's a kind of a notion of fear in your lifestyle choices.
Jeff Sluka is an associate professor in social anthropology at Massey University.
So our marketing people use it. There is no difference at all between propaganda and advertising. Advertising is propaganda. The basic texts of advertising came from the studies of Nazi propaganda that came out after the Second World War. So the use of fear as a form of propaganda, a form of controlling people and getting them to do what you want to do, manipulating them, is pervasive throughout our whole culture, from the government to advertising. We've done some research on whether you are born with any fears. Perhaps the brain is wired that we'll be afraid of certain kinds of things. And we have found nothing there, nothing that's not culturally loaded. Is there a universal fear of spiders? No. Is there a universal human fear of anything? We haven't found any universal human fears, except a few. Some of those include things like the fear of being banished from our families. All cultures have that. So we think that maybe that's a biological one, that you're born with an ability to be afraid of being alone.
Jeff's right. We all want to fit in with our peers and be part of a successful, healthy, hardworking community. Because without that, we can't survive. But today, survival of the fittest means survival of the thinnest.
There's this productivity guy that has this quote that people's two big fears are getting fat and too much email. Two of the big fears of the modern world, and weight stigma is a huge problem. Like, it's one of the very few stigmas that's still socially acceptable. The rates of both overweight and obesity are going up for New Zealanders. We're now sort of in the teens for the most overweight and obese countries.
Alice Boys is a Christchurch-based clinical psychologist specialising in treatment for anxiety, depression, eating disorders and relationships.
You know, people talk about healthorexia and people being obsessed with healthy eating, and people's level of nutrition understanding and just kind of basic science knowledge is often very poor. You know, I think marketing is so sophisticated these days that it really does suck people in. And so people are very prone to these fads and trends. Food marketers have realised that they can latch onto that and charge inflated prices for gluten-free products or for products labelled organic. And so there's obviously an important real basis to, for people with celiac disease. Because of all the messages about health, anything that's harder to achieve often becomes more desirable. People feel a huge sense of pressure to be perfect in all the domains of their life.
And with a saturated market of airbrushed images of celebrities gracing the covers of magazines, our idea of perfection can't help but be somewhat altered.
People that expose themselves more to magazines that promote that ultra-thin ideal or watch TV programs that really emphasise appearance have more disordered food behaviours and poor body image. There are some personality traits that have been identified sort of mainly around things like perfectionism, a tendency to rigidity or obsessionality. For bulimia, the risk factors seem to be a bit broader. So if they've got relatives that have got sort of impulse control problems, so gambling, as well as mood problems. And there are some kind of social factors as well, like parents are initially encouraging their child to lose weight or promoting kind of fatty attitudes around food.
So are eating disorders a modern day illness?
There are reports of anorexia, from 100 years ago, but those were very, very rare until around 50 years ago. The rates have absolutely exploded.
Having a fear of food and weight gain all comes down to a desire for control. And disordered eating affects every aspect of the individual's life, triggering other peripheral fears and ritualistic patterns of behaviour.
obsession with food all the time. Body checking and body avoidance are other big issues. People often have a measure for themselves of what is acceptable. It might be that they look at themselves in the mirror every morning and look to make sure that their thighs aren't touching. Or the opposite of that, where people would avoid weighing themselves or would avoid looking at themselves, so they might wear very baggy clothing. People will avoid sex and dating if they're uncomfortable with their body. You know, someone that's overweight might avoid eating junk food in front of other people because they're fearful of getting criticised for it.
Living with disordered eating behaviour isn't easy, as Liz knows all too well. She's been caught in a perpetual cycle of out-of-control eating to numb her fears. She joined Overeaters Anonymous over a year ago, and recovery has helped her to lose weight. But taking control of what she refers to as an addiction will be a lifelong battle in an environment of abundance.
We practice the same 12 steps that Alcoholics Anonymous do. We believe that a power greater than ourselves will help us stay abstinent. I don't necessarily mean God. Some people use the group as a power greater than themselves. My experience was that I couldn't do it on my own. There's certain tools that we use in OA, and one of those is a food plan. And most people generally define their abstinence by deciding in advance what they're going to eat. So that might be 3 meals a day, that might be 6 meals a day. Some people weigh and measure each portion that they eat, some people don't. And OA, you know, abstinence is defined as, you know, refraining from compulsive overeating. I came to OA at, you know, at 100 kgs. Compulsive overeating is, I suppose, a spectrum, really. At one end there's overeating, and then at the other end there's undereating.
You would say you were a compulsive eater?
Oh, yeah, I'd say definitely. I've probably had a problem with food since I was a small child.
In what sense?
I've had periods of getting bigger and then smaller and then bigger and then smaller.
What would you put that down to?
Dysfunctional family, but then I've met a lot of people who have dysfunctional families and they don't try and eat themselves sick. Predisposition. Well, my sister had anorexia.
Oh.
Yeah, for as long as I can remember, my mum's had an obsession with her weight as well. That's another thing that defines compulsive overeating usually, or undereating, is the obsession, you know, body obsession. But I do have the association of not feeling good eating and then feeling better.
Was that debilitating?
Oh, no, of course it was. Yeah, like I couldn't walk up stairs and that kind of stuff because I was so large. I had problems breathing, sweating, like, and the doctor said something to me about my weight. And then I started getting worried that I was going to get diabetes or have a heart attack. Like, I'd eat, like, normal food. Then I'd just drive down the dairy, like, buy 2 packets of chippies, go home and eat them, you know, like a big bottle of soft drink. My ability to process life disappeared, really, and so I was just eating. So I was eating because I was scared, I was eating because I was happy, and I think I probably started eating maybe because I was probably socially maybe a bit lonely. It's a perpetuating disease, though, do you know what I mean? Because then I was staying at home and eating and being lonely. Because in theory, if that was the only problem, all I'd have to do is find some friends. This is the idea that I suffered from as well, you know, which is what kept me eating, was that I thought it was because I had fear of people or fear of life. And I thought that once I overcame those, that then I'd be all right and I'd be able to eat normally. I suppose what's happened is that I've had to learn to eat normally and then deal with that other stuff.
A real fear of ostracisation was instilled in a young Craig Hoyle from childhood. Born and raised in Invercargill as a 7th-generation exclusive Brethren meant that he was under constant watchful eyes from other members of the community, who were all taught to fear the rest of society.
I think the exclusive Brethren are all about fear. Former members of the church often say that the Brethren are based on the 3 F's, fear, finances and family, and that's what keeps people in the church. Financially, you're completely tied to the church. Usually you'll be working for a church business. You might have taken a loan from another church member instead of from the bank when you started your business. Same thing for your house. They might have given you bridging finance on property. If they've connected you back into the school trust. And it just becomes incredibly difficult to extricate yourself from that. Bearing in mind that they don't let you go to university, so you don't get any qualifications. We weren't allowed aspirations. I knew that I would grow up and go into the family business, which was tyres. And eventually my father would retire and I would take over the business and that would be my life. It was all planned out. The church was the one true position and we were the only people who had the true light and everybody else was wrong. And when you teach small children that, sort of leads very quickly to feelings of superiority. But as you got older, you were told that the world was a cold, hard place, that it would chew you up and spit you out. And the church was the only place you would find love, warmth and acceptance. So the church was regarded as a safe haven. And, of course, we had no knowledge of the world outside. You know, the common mantra was, if you don't understand it, don't question it. And we'll do the thinking, you do the doing. You know, if you allow one question in your mind, it'll unravel your whole belief system. So, ergo, you shouldn't have that one question to start with. They forbid anything that involves higher education, so you can't go on to become a doctor, a lawyer, a dentist, or so on. For the longest time, degrees were frowned upon. When they banned degrees in the 1960s, the edict from the leadership was that everybody who had a degree should piss on it. So growing up in the church, for my generation, technology was forbidden. So there was no access to the internet. You were allowed typewriters, but you weren't allowed word processors or computers or anything like that. No TV, no radio. You weren't allowed to go to the cinemas. You weren't allowed to interact socially with anyone who wasn't a member of the church, and even newspapers were frowned upon. They changed the rules in the 1960s about pets because they believed that animals came between you and God. And I remember my grandmother telling me that at that point they actually had to take the family cash and put it in a bag and throw it in the river. I mean, that was how abruptly everybody had to get rid of their pets. They fixate on sex a lot, and with that level of control, if you're walking down the street, you were only supposed to look straight ahead. If you saw someone that you were sexually attracted to, if you looked at them the first time, it wasn't a sin because you couldn't help it, but if you looked back a second time, it became a sin. And if you held the first look for more than 1 or 2 seconds, then the first look was also a sin. When I was a teenager, I started running away. I would disappear. I would go to the movies and things like that. And I think in my case, it was just a desperation, wanting to know more about what was outside the church. I'll never forget being at church meetings with the world leader, and he said that the minute you walk over the threshold at the cinema, the Spirit of God departs from you. And, you know, by the grace of God, someone from the church might come and save you, but it was a life and death gamble. But you step over the threshold and you think, well, you know, blow me down, the Spirit of God just left me. Then you think, well, I'm here, so I might as well watch the movie.
But for someone from the exclusive Brethren faith, a night at the movies has its consequences.
Typically what would happen is they would go looking for you. So there were times when I would have, you know, 6 different vehicles with Brethren in them sort of going up and down the street, and they'd go up and down until they found where you'd parked the car, and then they would sort of fan out from there to sort of try and establish where you were. And
but nothing will keep Craig from his newfound freedom. He continues to push the church's boundaries by eventually coming out about his homosexuality, which has severe repercussions.
One day I came home from work and told my brothers and sisters that I was gay. I have 6 siblings that are all younger than me. That night, the church came and took all my brothers and sisters away, sent them to live with other people. And subsequently, they entered the first stage of excommunication. And their official wording was evil communications, and they defined evil communications as telling my brothers and sisters that I was gay. I've had almost no contact with my family since I left, which was in 2009. My father wrote to me telling me never to contact the family. They'll remove all trace that you ever existed. All the photos will come off the walls. Any mention of you will come off the directories. They'll completely take you off the family tree. It's as though you never existed. When my siblings have children, my nephews and nieces will possibly be unaware that there's even another uncle. I knew what the consequences would be of coming out. I was able to make preparations, and so I was aware of the emotional consequence. I would describe them as a cult. Having come from that environment and having seen the level of fear and control and the damage that it had on people's lives.
The use of fear and control is incredibly damaging, especially for those who have experienced prolonged periods of trauma or stress. Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at NYU, Joseph Ledoux.
There's a lot of research both in animals and in humans that shows that prolonged and severe stress will actually cause dendrites, those are the sort of the antennas of neurons in the brain, to shrivel up in certain areas like the hippocampus, which is very important in long-term memory, and the prefrontal cortex, which is very important in emotional regulation and cognitive function and so forth. If the stress continues over a long period of time, then it can have damaging effects on these key brain areas. And at the same time, in addition to sort of weakening those areas, it facilitates the amygdala, which causes the stress response to continue. So it's a feed-forward cycle driven by the amygdala, which then begins to wear down the regulatory mechanisms in the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex. So it becomes an endless and devastating cycle. If you get out of that cycle after, you know, a certain period of time, then the changes are reversible. But if the stress continues for a very long period of time, the neurons in the brain that are affected can actually die and are difficult to replace when that happens.
Long periods of prolonged stress is part and parcel of military deployment, but the soldiers are well equipped to handle combat, both physically and psychologically, so that they're fearless in the face of war.
Fearlessness, I would say, is sort of a lack of an emotional state. Obviously, it's the absence of fear, where you'll deny that emotional arousal of some sort.
Dr. Craig Bryan is a clinical psychologist in cognitive behavioral psychology and associate director for the National Center for Veteran Studies at the University of Utah.
Whereas courage is experiencing fear, knowing that you're afraid, and choosing to act anyway. When I'm working with military personnel, as I say, the problem isn't fear or lack of fear. The problem is what you do with that and how you choose to respond to that internal emotional state. If you're going to form and run an effective military, you would definitely want to select individuals who tend to be younger. They are more likely to engage in high-risk activities. They are able to suppress fear. They can tolerate physical discomfort, adversity, injury, and they are able to suppress or push away negative emotional states in order to stay focused. And that's really what makes for an effective service member. The kind of flip side of that, of course, is that many of those characteristics can also lend themselves to suicide risk. So we know for a fact that people who fear death tend not to kill themselves, right? And so if you select for people who are not afraid to die, you have chosen a great characteristic for the military. Kind of the other side of the coin is they also have removed this protective factor for suicide.
Developing fearlessness and suppressing one's fears is all part of a psychological process which is identified through military training.
We call it an opponent process. It's actually a well-known psychological principle. And we see it not only in the military, but you can see it in a lot of different areas as well. So another maybe more familiar case of the opponent process is something like skydiving or bungee jumping. The first time people engage in these high-risk activities, there's frequently a fear associated with it. But what happens is then after the event occurs, that fear gets replaced with a positive emotion, typically excitement or exhilaration, which then reinforces, you know, that emotional response. So the next time you go ride a roller coaster, or the fear is less and you habituate to it, the positive emotion, the exhilaration, becomes more and more pronounced. I mean, if you talk with a lot of combat veterans, many of them will actually describe a similar experience. We kind of train them how to respond to that as a part of their indoctrination into the military, so that they can acquire that habituation from the very beginning and they start to acquire the positive emotions associated with it.
Developing fearlessness in the optimal soldier has its problems. And in the US, suicide is the second leading cause of death within the US military.
Suicide prevention is such a major focus within the US military right now. It's in the media constantly. I think the storyline, at least here in the United States, that has emerged over the past decade is, you know, service member goes to Iraq or Afghanistan. They see combat, they kill somebody, someone tries to kill them, something like that. They come back, they acquire PTSD, and they kill themselves. And what we know is yes, that is the storyline for many service members, but, you know, almost half of service members have never deployed. For even those who have deployed, the service members that we work with who are suicidal, they do have combat-related PTSD. What's really making them suicidal is their supervisor is a jerk. You know, they're having conflicts with their spouse and they can't pay their bills and all these sort of everyday problems. What we think ends up happening is the storyline gets distorted. How does that affect the service member? We don't know. I mean, do they kind of have now in their head this mentality of, well, this is just what service members do. You just have problems and I've deployed and, you know, so you kill yourself. There are some units who have responded very negatively to their service members dying by suicide, very sort of hostile. You'll get sort of that ambivalent response in many units. You'll have others who respond in a very positive way. You know, suicide within our nation as a culture is actually tragically one of the leading reasons why people die. Very young people between the ages of 15 to about the mid 40s, suicide is like the second or third leading cause of death in the United States. And what we've seen in the military over the past decade or so is that it has risen up, and there are a lot of factors that are contributing to it, but we just think that the primary one is the stress level right now within the U.S. military after a decade of armed conflict.
Another contributing factor to the high rate of suicide within the military in the US is access to firearms. But research also reveals that certain variables need to be in place before someone takes their own life.
Thomas Joyner is a suicide researcher at Florida State University. He argues that there are three essential ingredients for someone to make a near lethal suicide attempt or to die by suicide. Two of those components are called perceived burdensomeness and thwarted belongingness. This comprises what he calls the desire for suicide. You have to want to kill yourself in order to do it. And perceived burdensomeness is the perception, it's a faulty perception that my living is actually a liability to others, and so my death is a favor. Thwarted belongingness is, of course, a sense of detachment and isolation and not feeling connected with other people. Then the third component of his particular theory is something that he calls the acquired capability for suicide or fearlessness. This is sort of the aspect of the theory that determines who can kill themselves. And so on the one hand, you have to want to die by suicide in order to do so. But on the other hand, you have to be able to do it. Acquired capability, or that fearlessness aspect, what Thomas argues is that over time you can learn to no longer fear death and also to habituate or tolerate increasingly high levels of physical pain, which is also another requirement in order to kill yourself. There are actually a couple of studies going on right now in which we are imaging the brains of suicidal individuals, specifically veterans and military personnel, to look at if there are differences in brain functioning, brain structure, differences in how they process or experience information. Many of us believe that there's this underlying vulnerability that some people have for suicide. They lack the capacity to tolerate emotions. They lack the capacity to generate alternatives and solutions to their problems. And so when they become very emotionally distressed, they lose the ability to solve problems, which is deficient already. And suicide then becomes the answer or the solution for eliminating their emotional distress. So perfectionism, for instance, is one personality trait that has a strong link to suicide risk. Part of the reason why is that we think that those types of personality styles have a high level of negative self-judgment. They feel like they're defective. They experience high levels of shame. They're black and white types of thinkers. And that significantly lends itself to emotional regulation problems.
Suicide within the US military is a problem that's on the rise, but for war veterans experiencing PTSD, rehabilitation isn't simple, especially after intensive training in a culture that promotes and reinforces mental and physical toughness.
We have, you know, tried to convince military personnel it's okay to get help, but that message defies you know, the service member sense of identity, which is you're tough, handle things on your own. Because if you can't take care of your problems and handle the stress, well, then you're a weak link and you're a liability to everybody else in the unit. And so our traditional approaches then, in essence, are asking service members to abandon their sense of identity. And so that's where many of us are saying this isn't working, you know, and it probably is not ever going to work because the military is not going to stop training people to view themselves in this tough, elite, superior way. And indeed, I would argue it's probably not a good idea to train service members in any other way. And so what we have to do then as a society, as mental health professionals, as military leaders, policy, everybody else basically has to then say, how are we going to meet the service member on their grounds and help connect with them in a way that's consistent with their cultural norms and their cultural identity?